Our first knowledge of Dai Yuan dates from Zheng Chen, a native of Hancheng in the south of Shenxi province. At that time, the Son of Heaven made inquiries among those of the Sheng Nu, who had surrendered and been made prisoners, and they all reported that the Sheng Nu had overcome the king of the Yueji and made a drinking vessel out of his skull. The Yueji were hiding somewhere, constantly scheming how to revenge themselves on the Sheng Nu. The Chinese, wishing to declare war on the Huns to wipe them out, when they learned this, desired to establish contact with the Yueji, but the road to them led through the territory of the Huns. The emperor called for volunteers. Zheng Chen responded to the call and enlisted in a mission to seek out the Yueji. He took with him Kan Fu, a Tatar who had been a slave of the Tungi family, and set out from Kansu to cross the border into Han territory. When Zheng Chen started on his journey, he had more than 100 men in his caravan. 13 years later, only 2 had lived to return. Having marched many days to the west, he arrived at Dai Yuan. The inhabitants, having heard of the wealth and fertility of China, had vainly tried to communicate with it. When, therefore, they saw Zheng Chen, they asked joyfully, "Where do you wish to go?" Since that time, the Yueji had conquered Daxia and occupied the country. It was a rich and fertile land, seldom harassed by robbers, and the people decided to enjoy this life of peace. After having made his way through so many tribes to find Daxia, Zheng Chen was unable to persuade the Yueji to move against their former enemy. He remained there for a year. Of the countries he had visited personally, Zheng Chen gave this report to the emperor. Dai Yuan is to the southwest of the Huns and due west of China at a distance of about 10,000 li. The people are settled and engage in agriculture. In their fields they raise rice and wheat. They have wine made of grapes and many good horses. They have walled cities and houses, the large and small cities belonging to them. Their arms consist of bows and halberds, and they can shoot arrows while on horseback. Daxia is more than 2,000 li to the southwest of Fergana, on the south bank of the Oxus. The people have fixed abodes and live in walled cities and regular houses like the people of Dai Yuan. They have no great king or chief, but everywhere the cities and towns have their own petty chiefs. While the people are shrewd traders, their soldiers are weak and afraid to fight. The population of Daxia may amount to more than 1 million. To the southeast of it is the country of India. India may be several thousand li to the southeast of Bactria. The people there have fixed abodes, and their customs are very much like those of Daxia, but the country is low, damp, and hot. The people ride on elephants to fight in battle. The Son of Heaven, on hearing all this, reasoned thus: Dai Yuan and the possessions of Daxia and Parthia are large countries, full of rare things. With a population living in fixed abodes and given to occupations somewhat identical with those of the Chinese people, but with weak armies and placing great value on the rich produce of China. On his return to China, Zheng Chen was appointed Great Traveller, or head of the Office of Foreign Affairs. China would eventually come west almost 1,000 years later, only to be stopped in the Battle of Talas by the Abbasid Empire, losing upwards of 50,000 men. Now Torval made ready for his voyage with 30 men, and took counsel thereupon with Leif, his brother. They made their ship ready and put to sea, and nothing is told of their voyage until they came to Vinland. There they laid up their ship and spent a pleasant winter, and caught fish for their support. But in the spring, said Torvald, they should make ready the ship, and that some of the men should take the ship's longboat round the western part of the island, and explore there during the summer. They found neither dwellings of men nor beasts, except upon an island to the westward, where they found a corn shed of wood. But the next summer went Torvald eastward with the ship. They sailed away round the eastern shores of the land and into the mouths of the firths, which lay nearest thereto, and to a point of land. There they came to with the ship and shoved a plank out to the land, and Torvald went up to the country with all his companions. He then said, "Here it is beautiful, and here I would like to raise my dwelling." Then they went to the ship, and saw upon the sands within the promontory three elevations, and saw there three skin boats, and three men under each. They then divided their people and caught them all except one who got away with his boat. They killed the other eight and then went back to the cape and looked around them and saw some heights inside of the frith and supposed these were dwellings. After that, so great a drowsiness came upon them that they could not keep awake, and they all fell asleep. Then came a shout over them so that they all awoke. Thus said the shout, "Wake thou, Thorvald, and all thy companions, if thou wilt preserve life, return thou to thy ship with all thy men and leave the land without delay." Then rushed out from the interior of the frith an innumerable crowd of skin boats and made towards them. Thorvald said then, "We will put out the battle screen and defend ourselves as well as we can, but fight little against them." So did they, and the Skraelings shot at them for a time, but afterwards ran away, each as fast as he could. Then asked Thorvald his men if they had gotten any wounds. They answered that no one was wounded. "I have gotten a wound under the arm," said he, "and here is the arrow, and it will prove a mortal wound to me. Now counsel I ye that ye get ready instantly to depart, but ye shall bear me to that cape where I thought it best to dwell. There shall ye bury me, and set up crosses at my head and feet." Now Thorvald died, but they did all things according to his directions and then went away. In the spring they made ready to sail to Greenland, and now could tell great tidings to Leif. Ibn Fadlan said, "I also saw the Rusia. They had come to trade and had disembarked at the Ittle River. I've never seen bodies as nearly perfect as theirs. As tall as palm trees, fair and reddish, they wear neither tunics nor caftans. Every man wears a cloak with which he covers half his body, so that one arm is uncovered. They carry axes, swords and daggers, and always have them to hand. They use Frankish swords with broad, ridged blades. They are dark from the tip of their toes right up to their necks, trees, pictures, and the like. They are the filthiest of God's creatures. They have no modesty when it comes to defecating or urinating, and do not wash themselves when intercourse puts them in a state of ritual impurity. They do not even wash their hands after eating. Indeed, they are like roaming asses. They arrive, moor their boats by the Ittle, and build large wooden houses on its banks. They share a house in groups of 10 and 20, sometimes more, sometimes fewer. They are accompanied by beautiful female slaves for trade with the merchants. They have intercourse with their female slaves in full view of their companions. They must wash their faces and their heads every day with the filthiest and most polluted water you can imagine. Let me explain. Every morning a female slave brings a large basin full of water and hands it to her master. He washes his hands, face and hair in the water. Then he dips the comb in the water and combs his hair. Then he blows his nose and spits in the basin. He is prepared to do any filthy, impure act in the water. When he has finished, the female slave carries the basin to the man next to him, who performs the same routine as his comrade. She carries it from one man to the next and goes around to everyone in the house. Every man blows his nose and spits in the basin and washes his face and hair. They disembark as soon as their boats dock. Each carries bread, meat, onions, milk, and alcohol to a large block of wood set in the ground. The piece of wood has a face on it, like the face of a man. It is surrounded by small figurines placed in front of large blocks of wood set in the ground. He prostrates himself before the large figure and says, "Lord, I have come from a distant land, with such and such a number of female slaves and such a number of sable pelts." He lists all his merchandise. Then he says, "And I have brought this offering." He leaves his offering in front of the piece of wood, saying, "I want you to bless me with a rich merchant with many dinars and dirhams who will buy from me whatever I wish and not haggle over any price I set." When one of them falls ill, they pitch a tent far away and lay him down inside with some bread and water. They do not approach him or speak to him. Indeed, they have no contact with him for as long as he is ill, especially if he is a social inferior or a slave. If he recovers and gets back on his feet, he rejoins them. If he dies, they set fire to him. They do not bury dead slaves, but leave them as food for the dogs and the birds. I was told that they set fire to their chieftains when they die. Sometimes they do more, so I was very keen to verify this. Then I learned of the death of an important man. When the deceased is poor, they build a small boat for him, place him inside, and burn it. When he is rich, they collect his possessions and divide them into three portions. One third goes to his household, one third is spent on funeral garments, and one third is spent on the alcohol. His female slave is cremated with her master. They are addicted to alcohol. They drink it night and day. Sometimes one of them dies, cup in hand. When the chieftain dies, all members of his household ask his female and male slaves, who will die with him? One answers, I will. At this point, the words become binding. There is no turning back. It's not even an option. It's usually the female slaves who offer. An aged woman, whom they call the Angel of Death, turns up. She spreads the coverings on the couch. It is her responsibility to sew the chieftain's garments and prepare him properly, and it is she who kills the female slaves. I saw her myself. She was gloomy and corpulent, but neither young nor old. The deceased's nearest male friend comes forward. He picks up a piece of wood and sets the boat alight. He was completely naked. He walked backwards, the nape of his neck towards the boat, his face towards the people. He set fire to the wooden structures under the boat. The people came forward with sticks and firewood. They each carried a lighted stick that they threw on top of the wood. The wood caught fire, then the boat, the yurt, the dead man, the female slave, and everything else on board caught fire. A fearsome wind picked up. The flames grew higher and higher and blazed fiercely. One of the Rusir was standing beside me. I heard him speaking to the interpreter who was with me. I asked him what he had said, and he replied, he said, you Arabs, you are a lot of fools. Why is that? Because you purposefully take your nearest and dearest and those whom you hold in the highest esteem and put them in the ground, where they are eaten by vermin and worms. We, on the other hand, cremate them there and then, so that they enter the garden on the spot. In the reign of Mikada Gonara no In, the 108th emperor since the days of Jimmu, sometime around the Koji period, a southern barbarian trading vessel came to our shores. From this ship, for the first time, emerged an unnameable creature, somewhat similar in shape to a human being, but looking rather more like a long-nosed goblin, or the giant demon Mikoshi Nayudo. Upon close interrogation, it was discovered that this was a being called Bataren. The length of his nose was the first thing which attracted attention. It was like a conch shell, though without its surface warts, attached by suction to his face. His eyes were as large as spectacles, and their insides were yellow. His head was small. On his hands and feet he had long claws, his height exceeded 7 feet, and he was black all over. Only his nose was red. His teeth were longer than the teeth of a horse. What he said could not be understood at all. His voice was like the screech of an owl. One and all rushed to see him, crowding all the roads in total lack of restraint, and all were agreed that this apparition was even more dreadful than the fiercest of goblins could ever be. Though at heart he planned to spread the Kurishitan religion, he seemed intent first to survey the wisdom of the Japanese people. He brought with him all sorts of manner of curious things from South Barbary. At that time, Prince Oda Nobunaga was master over the empire. Once in the course of an evening's conversation, he heard tell of that Uragan Bataren, and he uttered the desire to see the creature as soon as possible. After 2 or 3 days, the Bataren appeared before Nobunaga to pay obeisance. Word had spread that he was coming to pay obeisance to Nobunaga, so the great lords and lesser lords of all Japan, minor officials, townsmen, all rushed to see the sight, you could hardly push your way through the crowds. For presents, he brought 10 muskets, far-seeing and near-seeing spectacles, picture scrolls, medicines, goats and sheep, Cathay dogs, and many other artifacts in overwhelming numbers. Prince Nobunaga was not at all displeased. He gave the Bataran a plot of land and a residence and had a colossal temple built for him. And after that, the two Bataren, called Gorigori and Yarusu, were brought over. A native of the province of Hizen acted as their Japanese interpreter. Well then, the Kurishiten version of Buddhist doctrine tells us that at the time heaven and earth were opened up, the one Buddha, called Deus, as well as the Great Lord, made his appearance, creating the sun and the moon and illuminating the world. Once he had constructed the terrestrial domain, he let men live there in opulence. But he did not give man specific instruction on doing good or doing evil. Man's wisdom being but scant, he offended against Deus's law, and for that he is expediently thrust into Inferno, a place of darkness in the bowels of the earth. But they who do not diverge from Deus's teachings fly from here to Paraiso, a place of ease and pleasure in the heavens above. But what is the appearance of the Kurishitan temple? It contains a room of mystery, in which on display is an image of Deus, fashioned in the most gruesome manner, hanging upon a cross. This appears to be a device to extract tears of emotion from their sectarians by showing off this figure of agony and mortification. There is confessan, to come into the presence of the Buddha, do penance and contrition, and pray for happiness in the future world. And in the back of this room is the meeting room. On display here is an image of the matron Santa Maria after she gave birth to Deus, holding in her arms an infant in his second year. Now, the particular background of this image is as follows. The Buddha, called Deus, deeming it unlikely that sentient beings would themselves learn of Buddha's law or even of worldly law, and certain that they would doubt the mere statement that he is the Lord of heaven and earth, decided to be born himself into this world, and he caused the womb of Santa Maria to conceive and to give birth. Such is the meeting room. And the chamber in the back is called the Room of Repentance. Here the Bataren and Iruman and all their adherents all sit in a circle, while the penitent in its center publicly proclaims contrition of his sins and misdeeds, begging forgiveness and subjecting himself to severe humiliation. Thereupon, the Bataren, taking into his hands the aforementioned penitentia, flogs the sinner, causing the flow of blood. And the thing called cruz he values as all important, all the profundity of a saucer's depths, or so it would seem. Once a fool has turned his ready ear to something and set his heart to it, nothing will change his mind. To use an analogy, a child of 2 or 3 in seeing a reflection in a mirror thinks it is an actual figure. A monkey, in seeing the moon on the surface of the water, tries to grab it with his paws, for such is the simplicity of their minds. All fools are like that. I accompanied Messrs. Farewell Flynn and several seamen with about 40 natives on a journey to King Chaka of the Zula Nation. On the 8th day, after having travelled about 135 miles through a most picturesque country and crossed several rivers, we arrived at the summit of a mountain, from which the view was particularly grand and imposing. We could distinguish the king's residence and numerous other kraals on extensive plain encompassed by a chain of hills. Shortly afterwards, we came to a brook, where we refreshed and put ourselves in proper apparel to meet the king. A domestic now informed us that the king was holding an endaba with his warriors. We then proceeded in order and soon discovered his majesty and his court surrounded by large fires. We stood for a few minutes while the chief who accompanied us addressed the king relative to our mission, After this, we were desired to advance, presented our presence, and seated ourselves on the ground, about 6 paces from him. During this interview, his discourse was principally on war, owing to his enemies being at hand. He shortly afterwards dismissed his people and retired to his private kraal. We then received a message requesting that we would wait upon him there. Here, our reception was very different from the former. He now cast off his stern look, becoming good-humoured and conversed with us through our interpreters on various subjects. A large basket of boiled beef and several earthen pots of milk were ordered to be placed before us, of which we ate heartily. In the evening we were highly entertained by his warriors singing war and other songs. At the king's request, we fired a train of powder to show its effects. The following morning proved exceedingly hot, so much so that it was scarcely possible to stir about. We therefore kept within our hut. The king, however, feeling no inconvenience from it, sent for our sailors and proposed their going with him and a number of his people to hunt the elephant. These men, being aware of their inability and having only leaden balls, prudently declined, saying they could not go without consulting us. The king desired the interpreter to tell them they were afraid. This touched their pride of the insufficiency of our arms, of which we were equally aware, to destroy such animals. We immediately went in pursuit of them, and soon fell in with the king, surrounded by his warriors, sat under a large tree, from which he had a complete view of the valley, out of which they intended to start the elephant. We took our station about 200 yards from him, under a smaller tree, waiting impatiently, yet dreading the result. 2 hours had nearly elapsed when a messenger presented to the king the tail of an elephant, at which they all appeared greatly surprised, and said the white people had killed the animal. As may be supposed, we could scarcely credit the fact, but hastened towards the forest to join our people, and met them almost exhausted. It appeared that the natives drove the elephant from the forest to a plain, where the sailors placed themselves directly before the animal. The first shot entered under the ear. When it became furious, the other lodged near the foreshoulder, after which it fell and soon expired. Had this affair turned out differently, we should, in all probability, have been held in a contemptible light by this nation, and awkward consequences might have resulted to the settlement. In the evening, in request of the king, we joined in their amusements and could not ourselves avoid singing. We commenced with God Save the King. On our explaining its literal meaning, Chaco was highly pleased. In fact, there was nothing but good humour to be observed in the countenance of everyone present. The party broke up at a late hour, and as is usual, in the morning we paid the king an early visit. We now expressed a wish to see him in his war dress. He immediately retired and in a short time returned attired. His dress consists of monkey skins, in 3 folds from his waist to the knee, from which 2 white cow's tails are suspended, as well as from each arm. Round the head is a neat band of fur stuffed, in front of which is placed a tall feather, and on each side a variegated plume. He advanced with his shield, an oval about 4 feet in length, and an umkonto, or spear, when his warriors commenced a war song. Chaka is about 38 years of age, upwards of 6 feet in height, and well proportioned. While sitting in our hut at a late hour, we were aroused by the shrieks of thousands of human voices that we naturally concluded were the enemy advancing, being aware they expected them hourly. The real cause, however, was soon ascertained, which was the death of the king's grandmother, supposed to be between 90 and 100 years of age. Men, women, and children, having cried bitterly for several hours, there ensued a profound silence, after which thousands at the same moment commenced a most doleful song, which lasted a night and the greater part of the following day. It is said that this is the only instance ever known of the king having grieved. The day arrived for our departure. Chaka made us a present of 107 head of cattle. We then took our leave, with a promise of returning as early as possible.